This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening? Wait, Dr. Lyle? Hello? Are you there? Oh, no. Dr. Lyle's actually not with us this evening. We had a little slight change of the show format today, so I'm going to tell you about that in just a second. But first, I wanted to share a little story with our listeners. So Dr. Lyle and I have been doing this show for probably about 4 years now, almost 4 years. And we're getting close to 200 episodes of fresh, groundbreaking information, all based on Dr. Lyle's revolutionary approach. And I know I haven't shared much about myself throughout the show, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But mainly it's because I wanted the show to be about Dr. Lyle's revolutionary approach, where he combines the science of the mind and his decades of clinical experience as a psychologist. Now, some of you may know that I was first introduced to Dr. Lyle and his ideas when I was personally struggling to find answers about my own health. I had read several thousand pages of books, magazines, lecture notes. I went to conferences, called up authors of books, asked them to clarify some of their ideas for me. I went to conferences searching for answers. I was pestering speakers, even doctors in the audience and researchers for answers. And I was trying to tie in all of this health information I'd read to try to make some sense out of it. But honestly, it just felt like someone had ripped open a big, huge bag of Skittles in my kitchen, and I was just frantically and hopelessly trying to collect them. And then, by just some plain, pure, dumb luck, I happened to go to True North Health Center for a stay. And I was ready to leave, having had no idea that Dr. Lyle and Dr. Goldhammer had written a book. But funny enough, due to some ridiculously small billing error, the secretary, they had actually overcharged me for my stay by a few bucks. And the secretary, she actually offered to give me Dr. Lyle's book, The Pleasure Trap, for free so that she wouldn't have to reprint the bill. And so I got home, started reading the book, and I remember the feeling of just calm euphoria, mental euphoria as I read each chapter. And then over the next few hours, I literally read the book cover to cover, just in kind of disbelief and shock over how much sense it was making relative to everything else I had read up until that point. So Dr. Lyle, Dr. Goldhammer, they tied together every piece of health information that I'd been looking into over the last few years. And as Dr. Lyle often says on this show, he says, let's back up the camera. And that's exactly what the Pleasure Trap did. And so it's changed my life, clarified my thinking and my confusion in a way that I'd never thought possible. So a few years into doing this podcast, Dr. Lyle and I were talking on the phone one evening. And well, it's actually Dr. Lyle was explaining something to me, and I was trying my best to beat my genes and not interrupt him. But he mentioned to me about some researcher from Harvard who he had just happened to meet, that he was fascinated by the topic of her dissertation. And he said that she'll eventually join us on the podcast. So my first feeling, my first instinct, even though I didn't tell him, was, no way, I only want to hear from Dr. Lyle, and I only want to hear Dr. Lyle's ideas, and only his clinical experience is relevant to me. But as I learned more about her through Dr. Lyle, I could actually sense something as we backed up the camera, sense a similar feeling of excitement from Dr. Lyle about meeting this particular doctor as I did when I first read The Pleasure Trap and was looking forward to meeting Dr. Lyle and Dr. Goldhammer. But let's face it, in reality, it's probably 1,000 times more because I was on my little health journey for my own personal reasons, and I'd only been searching for a couple of years. I can't even imagine all the work Dr. Lyle has put in for probably several decades, putting together his ideas, and then finally meeting someone who's done the work in this area, helped clarify his thinking around the topic of trauma and self-esteem. And so a few months ago, we decided that it was time to introduce our very dedicated listeners to the mind of this Harvard researcher who will now be a regular on our show. And today, we have an entire show dedicated to her, a get to know Dr. Hawk, if you will. So I'm thrilled to have you on all by yourself today, Dr. Jen Hawk. Welcome to the Beat Your Genes show.
Oh, well, thank you, Nate. That was a lovely intro. Very, very sweet, complete with some funny missing Dr. Lyle humor. So well played.
And I hope our listeners can hear in the background Dr. Lyle's hearty laughter.
Yes.
Because I sure do every time I crack a joke, even to myself.
And just sits back there.
Mm-hmm. He's now a permanent part of my internal audience.
Oh, well, that's good. He's a better member of the internal audience than a lot of people would be. So much more fair.
Yeah. Well, so Dr. Hawk, it's the first time on the show all by yourself. You're new to the podcast. You've done, I think it's 2 to 3 shows already with us. Mm-hmm. We know that you went to Harvard, but what else can you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, we can't miss that little detail. We're just going to rub that in there. So, yeah. Well, what else can I tell you about myself? Well, I find it very amusing that we're the show where we're having a couple little technical difficulties is the first time I take the car out by myself. You know, of course, it's going to have run into a little bit of trouble. So that's good. So apologies to anyone for that. But yeah, so the background story is that I did indeed do my graduate work at Harvard. That is true. But there's a long, winding road that leads me to there. So I completed my PhD after much effort and much time and many sort of switcheroos on my topic, because I essentially, in the process of writing the dissertation, I really revised how I was thinking about the entire topic. I really reversed what I went in expecting to find. And anyone who's been on that kind of academic journey grappled with a big academic question and has kind of faced a fork in the road with a project like that where they've had to undergo that reversal knows that that's quite a process and takes a lot of time. So that has occupied most of the last decade of my life. But before that, I grew up in Alaska. I was born and raised in rural Alaska. It's something of a middle of nowhere kind of situation, you know, uphill both ways, you know, snowy and dark, little house out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was not quite a little house on the prairie situation, but it was on the little house on the prairie continuum for
sure.
We were
little house on the tundra.
Little house on the tundra for sure. I mean, we had neighbors, but not many. And we were pretty remote and pretty isolated. And in the early years, it was we were living very rustically. My parents had a little bit of a back to the land kind of thing that they were doing. They were sort of they were a little too young to be true hippies, but they had some hippie sentiments. So we were pretty far off the grid, and it was an interesting way to grow up. I have one younger brother who some listeners may know, or who have seen me at True North or whatever. He's in a very successful band these days, so he's well known for his musical adventures. So we're still very, very close. So it was just the two of us and the various domestic animals and farm animals that we had in the family growing up. And my parents, who were both journalists, they were, my dad was a radio guy mostly. He was the news director of public radio in Anchorage for many years. And dabbled around with a lot of other AM radio and various other things over the years. My mom was mostly a newspaper journalist who did everything from, you know, police beats to covering the arts beat for the Anchorage Daily News. So, very strange little rural childhood. We moved when I was in high school to, or middle school, I guess, to the town that is now infamous for being the hometown of the esteemed Sarah Palin. So, who actually we knew fairly well, had some direct connections with. So that's what's really put Wasilla, Alaska on the map, is its claim to Sarah Palin. So there's not much else you can say about it. Little town, you know, about 50 miles north of Anchorage. So, and grew up, but, you know, I'm a, technically speaking, an open whack job on the Big Five. So I'm over 90th percentile open. And so as soon as I could, I was out of there. I was off exploring. I was doing all kinds of weird things. I managed to finagle my way to study abroad my senior year in high school. I went to Germany, and this was right after the Cold War. I mean, this was the mid-90s. So it was a very fascinating time to be anywhere near the Eastern Bloc. I pretty much just kind of did that. I just wandered and did weird jobs and met weird people and had open experiences until I was about in my mid-20s. I think I was 26 when I finally had enough, you know, global wandering and chasing guitar playing Jimmies and getting my heart broken by guitar playing Jimmies. I finally settled down in Seattle, which is where my brother was living. And I happened to be chasing a boy who lived there. I settled in Seattle and did a couple of years in AmeriCorps, which is the National Service Program. Did a few more weird jobs and finally wound up at the University of Washington to finally get my bachelor's degree. And I felt about a million years old by that point because I was 26 or 27 when I started. And I still, at that point, really wanted to be in politics. I thought that politics was my calling. Technically speaking, my first job had been as an intern in the United States Senate. And then I had worked for many years in Alaska, in the Alaska State Legislature and in the governor's office. And I was really just fascinated by politics, really loved campaigns, just loved everything about politics. So once I got to the UW, I fell right into political science and fell in love with it and followed it all the way to grad school. And that's how I wound up doing a PhD in political science, of all things, which Harvard calls government, which is a little bit old-fashioned of them. There's only a couple of other places that do that. It's essentially the study of power, the study of institutions and power and who has power and why people obey and why they don't. And it's a fascinating discipline because it should embrace evolutionary psychology if it actually wants to understand these age-old questions about human political behavior, but it's absolutely not integrated with evolutionary psychology whatsoever. So I found myself kind of in a strange position having this skeleton key to the universe with EP and still kind of having this home and a discipline that the closest thing that political science has to evolutionary thinking is what we call rational choice, which comes from economics, which is just to kind of look at individual decision making from a very rational actor point of view, trying to maximize any given cost-benefit analysis. But it's not grounded in any kind of theory of human nature. There's no consilience. It's missing the whole big picture, but that's the closest that we had. That brings us pretty much current to, you know, when I stumbled into my dissertation and the work that I wanted to do, and then many years of angst while I came to grips with the truth of it and had to reverse the way that I was thinking about the whole problem, and a whole process around that, and eventually finishing and coming to True North, and now doing this full time, just like taking a deep dive into the EP world and really, really finally feeling intellectually at home.
Now, did you understand evolutionary psychology or EP, or is this something you kind of stumbled onto, or was it a feeling that something just isn't right? Or tell us about how you got interested in formally evolutionary psychology.
It was one of those things where just a lot of different forces kind of came together at the same time. So I think I had first heard of evolutionary psychology with The Moral Animal, which came out when I was in high school. So it made a big splash. It was a big sensation. You heard about the claims that were made in this book, and they were really scandalous. And I remember hearing a couple of these ideas, and I don't even remember. I don't think I read the book then, but somebody had a copy because I remember the picture on the cover, and there was a copy kicking around somewhere. Maybe my grandma had it, or my dad had it, or somebody had a copy. Someone got in their hands on one, and I remember pondering this idea that we're just animals and we behave in these predictable animalistic ways, and that's what's actually motivating us. And you know, that sounds about right. Like having that awareness as a teenager, you're never as in touch with animalistic impulse as you are when you're a teenager. So I was like, yeah, I think this is actually what's governing human behavior. But you know, I was crazy open. So it's not like I was going to, Dr. Lyle, you know, heard the Sermon on the Mount when he was around the same age, a little older, and that was it. You know, he's like, oh my God, that's the truth. That's it. I'm forever convinced. I'm just going to go deep on this for the rest of my life. And I was too open for that. I recognized that it was really valuable and that was something that was going to kind of run as a track in the background of my life, but it wasn't an ideology or a set of values that I was ready to really hitch my wagon to, because there was too much open exploring to do. So I had to just go wander in the weeds for a long time, and I went deep in the weeds. I mean, I spent years deep in the Enlightenment trap, deep in New Age thinking, all kinds of confused thinking about what was really motivating human action and what relationships were about and all of that. So I had a lot of distortion and a lot of confusion, but I could never really shut down completely that voice in my head. And I would think about these observations that come from evolutionary thinking, like these. I remember one of the very first things that I heard that just blew my mind was somebody pointed out, and I don't know if this was in The Moral Animal or if it was just if it had come maybe from The Blank Slate or somewhere else, that women's makeup is mimicking arousal. It's the reason that they put on makeup is to not only to send signs of fertility, but specifically signs of sexual arousal. And I thought about that, and like my 19-year-old brain was just absolutely blown by this information and the truth of it. Like, oh, of course that's what it is. You know, you've got big eyes and pink cheeks and, you know, inflated lips and this whole thing. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, like, If we're beholden to that, and this is underpinning this whole makeup industry, like how far down does this rabbit hole go? And then I would come across other little pieces of information here or there, you know, that women are attracted to different men at different points in their cycle, depending on whether they're ovulating or not. Different, you know, more testosteronized males when they're fertile, you know, more Horuses when they're not. And then also that they're like literally their faces change and their scent changes and their voice pitch changes when they're ovulating, and all of these signals, some of which we don't even know what they are. We just know that men find women more attractive, and they actually tip waitresses more when they're fertile than when they're not. There are all these studies that have replicated all of these kinds of things, and we've only pinned down a few of the actual mechanisms. Like, we don't actually even know what kind of invisible signals are being thrown during that time. So all these little tiny cues, just as a woman who was dating and was interested inherently in these things, I just found this inescapably fascinating. And then as a social scientist, I just kept churning away as I was thinking about what are these forces that are influencing social institutions and politics itself. Like, politics just seem to be, you know, if you're talking about power, it seems like you would have to think about these base animalistic impulses that people have. And it just seemed like there was something missing from all of that analysis. So it was always kind of in the background, even though I was getting trained classically in political science, which absolutely is uninterested in all of this stuff. All that classical political science really cares about is institutions and the design of institutions. So the notion is that you can, if you just get the constitution right, and you develop sufficient rule of law, that you can, it's all portable. It's all in principle portable to a different context. So it's very blank slate environmentalist thinking that it's all about the institutions. It's democracy is something that is, you know, portable to all kinds of different contexts if you just get the components right. So there was this inherent clash between those two things. And then a couple of years ago, I became aware of the work of Jordan Peterson. And I'm sure a lot of the podcast listeners are familiar with Peterson. He's you know, made quite a name for himself recently. And I actually had known about him for a very long time because I had had encountered his first book, Maps of Meaning, back when he published it. So I'd known about him for nearly 20 years, because I think that first book came out in the late 90s. And I had been, one of the things that I was really enduringly interested in was Jungian psychology and symbolism and archetypes and all of this mythical stuff that kind of intersected with my New Age Enlightenment trap. And he was very conversant in that. So he was like a blend of evolutionary psychology and this crack cocaine of Jungian symbolism and Jungian thinking and the hero's journey and all of this stuff. So I found that very appealing. I really, really liked that combination of things. It was like, oh, here's a little source code and a little mysticism just to take the edge off. So it was really, 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 really attractive.
Probably speaking right. Yeah, right to
totally. Yeah. Oh, completely speaking to my source code. And, you know, he delivered it in this really beautiful way. He's a great speaker and a great writer. Maps of Meaning is a really dense tome, but he has a lot of interesting things to say even in that book. And then he rockets back into the consciousness, the social consciousness, a few years ago. I want to say maybe 2016. It was right around the election. It was right around the Trump election, because of the so-called scandal that was happening in relation to his claims around compulsory language related to non-binary mm-hmm. gender expressions. So he got himself in all kinds. Yeah, he got himself in all kinds of trouble. He's a professor of psychology and a clinical psychologist who works at the University of Toronto primarily. And he went on record repeatedly and quite vigorously about how he was anxious about the idea of the state requiring the use of any kind of language. So the fact that it happened to be about gender expression was almost incidental to the claim that he was actually making, and this gets lost in all of the debates, because he's a scholar of totalitarian regimes, of the Nazis and the Soviet regime in particular, and he was very sensitive to essentially the state telling people how to speak. And if you do not say words, particularly words that have been invented, which was the case with these gender neutral pronouns that are not necessarily in common use in English, but they're being prescribed by the state as now you will say these words. He saw that as an early step on the road to sliding into totalitarian practices, and he spoke up about it. This is a very interesting claim that sort of lived in a very rarefied academic space for a while until a teaching assistant at another university in Canada used some of his arguments, found him on YouTube, and played some of his arguments for her class. She was teaching, I think, grammar, some sort of like composition or grammar, and they were literally having a conversation about pronoun use, and she said, oh, well, here's this guy has interesting thoughts on pronouns. So it was a little bit of a stretch to kind of impose his really political argument onto a discussion about pronoun usage and language use, but she did it, and she was roundly punished by her university, you know, stripped of her teaching credentials. Wow. Got into all kinds of trouble, and she actually recorded, she was brought up on a hearing and censured by this group, and she recorded it, and then she published the recording, and then it just blew up. Then everything went crazy, and all of this was coinciding, of course, with the election, and kind of with changing political priorities and a little bit of a backlash around identity politics, particularly, that Trump was able to really, you know, capitalize on. And also a couple of other things, like the protests at the Evergreen State College, which was actually right down the road from where I happened to be living in 2016. I was living in Olympia, Washington, which is where Evergreen is. Those protests were about, you know, professors that were sort of refusing to toe the line in similar ways that Peterson was refusing to toe the line. All of this kind of came rushing back into my consciousness around the same time that I'm essentially finishing the dissertation, and I'm coming to grips with the evolution of the argument that I was making in the dissertation, which began as I was very interested in Alaskan, indigenous Alaskans, and how they are coping or not coping successfully with the effects of climate change, because we can have a big debate about climate change if you want. Like, there's lots to talk about with it. But the fact is that the, you know, the climate patterns have changed in the Arctic, and these, there are populations that are very vulnerable to these effects, particularly these native villages, native Alaskan villages, that are one way or another going to have to relocate entirely away from the coast where they are, because the permafrost is eroding and the storms are stronger, and they're just completely imperiled by their environment in a way that they have not been in their current position. So I wanted to ask, you know, how can we make these places more resilient? And this was like, I was looking at this question in the way that I had been trained to look at this question. And this is what all of the literature was asking this question in the same way. Like, how can we create resilience? Where does resilience come from? Why do some institutions, this again is all about institutions, not about personality, not about cost-benefit analysis, but what are the institutions that make people more resilient or less resilient? And the deeper I got into that research, the more I realized that it was not really about the institutions at all, that you can't create resilience as much as you might like to, but there are entire state departments and bureaucracies that have been created to do so, despite the fact that they cannot do it, that all resilience is, like I was talking about on the podcast last week, is that it has everything to do with what we might call the opportunity structure that is facing different people in different contexts. So it really kind of goes back to that rational choice, rational actor model. Like, I'm a rational human with a cost benefit analysis on my situation. What are my opportunities? What are my constraints? How am I filtering all of that through the lens of my personality and my immediate personal cost benefit analysis? And that was a paradigm that made me very uncomfortable. It felt very impersonal. It felt very cold. It felt very, it was really at odds with my social justice commitments and my own environmentalist thinking. So that all of these things kind of came together at the same time. And I was confronted with this, the reality of the rational underpinnings of the utility of, essentially, if you're in a situation, In the dissertation, I'm pointing out how if you're in a situation where your economic hierarchy is disrupted, that you're in chaos, things are uncertain, the process of being in crisis itself can become strategic. So it's again kind of what we're talking about yesterday. If you're facing a competitive problem that you don't think that you're going to be successful confronting, the correct choice becomes to game it somehow. And so in this context, these populations have become essentially strategically vulnerable. And this is a two-way process that the state has something to gain from that, as well as the communities. So that's a very long-winded explanation of how I got there. But the evolutionary psychology was kind of there the whole time. But it was a combination of coming to terms in some kind of intellectual honesty with the work that I was doing in my field work and in my dissertation, the rise of Jordan Peterson. And then I'm sort of like on the cusp of this and writing this and trying to articulate it. And I moved to Santa Rosa to work at True North and I meet Dr. Lyle. So that's, you know, then that's the end of the story. Then I have this intellectual, person that I can really run these kinds of ideas by, who can give me really meaningful feedback, and we start to really shape each other's ideas through those exchanges. And it's just been incredibly rich intellectual exchange, and really, really amazing. So just to pick back up, I mean, I came to True North and I met Dr. Lyle, and we just, you know, immediately had this really rich intellectual exchange, because I was sort of developing some ideas that were useful to the way that he was thinking about things in ways that he hadn't quite sorted out. And then obviously he's enabling me to really get much more clarity around my own theory and how evolutionary principles are working on the observations that I'm making in my dissertation, and you know, grounding everything in just a richer consilience. So it was a really beautiful exchange.
It's absolutely fascinating, because I can only guess that politics is where evolutionary psychology is, becomes extremely practical from when it's dealing with more than one person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would think that it would be. And I think whether they are aware of it or not, it's definitely, you know, in regular use in the campaign world and in the actual political world. But the academic, the ivory tower perspective on political science has completely got its head in the sand and has no awareness of these realities. And rational choice, which again is like the closest we have, they're really kind of pariahs in the discipline. They're their own little... their own little group. They kind of just talk to each other. There's not a lot of cross-pollination between the rational choice.
You're talking about the evolutionary psychologists are the pariahs?
Yeah, and I wouldn't even call them evolutionary psychologists. I would call them more economists. They're political economy people. So they're bringing in principles from economics that are really useful to politics that are based around the idea of individual rationality. So it's next door to evolutionary psychology and evolutionary thinking, but they don't have any evolutionary theory. They don't have any consilience. They don't know why it works the way that it works. They don't really care. They just say, well, we're rational actors. We behave in rational ways. And so therefore we can build a model about what's going to happen under rational conditions, just like an economist would. And they get it right sometimes, and sometimes they don't, because they don't actually understand all of the different traps that people can get into, you know, the limits of what they would think of as rationality, essentially.
It's fascinating because the ones who are more successful than the others, I'm talking about setting up, you know, systems that are actually that help people get happy and accomplish their goals. They're just doing it by accident. They just happen to be, you're saying that they just happen to do it accidentally, and they might get it right in spite of not knowing these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think, you know, economics as a discipline is just a little closer to the truth than a lot of others are, just because it's made it its business to eliminate distortions in its thinking. And really, it's basically the whole discipline is founded on the idea of a cost-benefit analysis and market process, like an undistorted market process. And so if you import those ideas into political structures and political economy, you wind up sort of like a broken clock that's right twice a day. You're sort of like on the right track, but you don't know why you're on the right track. You're sort of close. And then, so, you know, political science also has, there are political psychologists, there's a division in the American Political Science Association for political psychology. And some of those people are looking at political problems through something like an evolutionary psychology lens, but some of them are looking through a completely haywire psychological lens that's drawing on psychodynamic, you know, family systems kind of BS. So, so there's no real coherence in the discipline around any of that. There's no agreement. It's kind of a free for all. But as you know, the classical, typical, standard poli-sci is about institutions. That's the end all be all. It's radical environmentalism.
Wow. Are there, now I was going to ask you if there's any common myths as to why, but I guess the institutions, I guess that's their payoff, is to keep the institutions alive. Are there myths that you think it's hard for me to, I'm not in this at all. So this is just me as a layperson, just kind of thinking out loud. But it's hard to imagine that that you've got people willfully ignoring the truth in favor of, you know, what will actually work.
I don't think they're willfully ignoring. I think they just don't know. I think there's a lot of inertia that happens in academia where you get very, like this happened to me. I got very siloed into poli-sci, and especially if you're pursuing it at the graduate level, you're in a lineage of thinkers that is a consistent way of looking at the world, and that's just how you're trained to see the world. And so you're well read on a particular canon. You're not reading other books. You're reading like exhaustively within the discipline as it exists. And there's just, this is not unique to poli-sci in any way, that there's, there's no interdisciplinary discussion, really. Anything interdisciplinary is kind of just a lark that people embark on for like some sort of special project or something, but there's very little systematic interdisciplinary work. So, you know, it's amazing to me that I was a couple of buildings down from Steven Pinker's office the whole time, and never thought to take a class or to sit in on a class, because I wasn't in that place yet with my thinking. By the time I really started to dial in on what we could call evolutionary principles that were at work in my dissertation and in my thinking, I was already out of Boston. I was doing my work in Alaska and elsewhere, so I kind of missed out on that opportunity. But it's also just not, it's not in anyone's awareness as an option. It's just not the way that grad school works. You kind of go very deep into your discipline and to be surrounded by the giants of your discipline and to learn to think like they think. And so it's not willful ignorance as much as it is conviction of the idea that you're right and everybody else is wrong, and you have a way of thinking about the world that is, you know, the most correct. And everybody's kind of operating under the same notion, no matter which branch of social science they're in. And everybody's confused.
Thank you for explaining it that way. It kind of, I can sniff that it's very similar to in the healthcare system right now.
Oh, very similar.
Where no one's really talking about diet, sleep, and exercise no one's talking about it. At least they weren't 20 years ago. And you can go ask like the average medical doctor, and they're just going to they're going to shrug their shoulders and say, diet's got, you know, very little to do with the particular condition. So this makes, that makes sense. Thank you.
And there's all the quiet little incentives, just like there are in the medical industry too, of, if you want to be successful doing this, it's publish or perish, and the journals are only going to publish certain kinds of articles, and you can go out on a limb and you can write a crazy dissertation and you can try to get your article published somewhere, but it's not going to be very noteworthy. And so you're not going to get a very fancy job, and you might struggle more to get tenure. And so people are just, they're subject to all of these normal motivations to climb the dominance hierarchy that they find themselves in. And the way to be successful in that dominance hierarchy is to play by the rules and to, not question too much. And it's not as if people are generally exposed to evolutionary thinking too much in their undergraduate careers either. So it's, I was in an unusual situation where, probably because of my openness, I had read widely and I had encountered these things and they were churning away. And I am just the type of, one of the reasons I am not in academia and I would never really fit in academia is I'm too busy grabbing ideas from wherever they're useful and wherever I can pull things and integrate them. And that is very much at odds with what it actually is required of a successful academic. To be a successful academic, you're going deep on one thing. You're keeping your head down. You're basically writing the same article over and over again with very slight permutations. You're going to change the statistical model just slightly to get a like different parameter and different result. And then you're going to go over here and you're going to test it out on a different case and see how that works. And you're going to tentatively make some conclusions about how that might have some implications, maybe in theory for some imaginary population down the road. So there's not a lot of practical on the fly, hey, there's this really cool idea over here, let's pull it in and see how it fits and how it might shed some light on a really big problem that we would all do well to understand. That just doesn't happen in academia.
And it's fascinating because when we first started this podcast, that's what drew me to Dr. Lyle is the fact that he was whatever works, what makes sense, and the clinical experience along with the science was what made the most sense. It's just fascinating that here you are basically in a different part of the world all the way across the country, coming to very similar conclusions, or at least watching the landscape of the world and seeing this whole thing unfold. And now here you are.
I know. Yeah, it's almost enough to fuel a person's mystic chip.
So I guess you believe in destiny then.
I don't not believe in destiny.
Well, Well, speaking of destiny, because you mentioned a little bit about climate change, and I know there's mm-hmm. a lot of you know different debates going on in climate change. So I'm not actually asking about debating climate change here. What I'm actually curious mm-hmm. about is what motivates people in this debate.
Mm. Yeah, well, you know, we say it all the time, but if you don't understand something, look for the status. It's really just it's one of those guidelines to kind of make your way through the world. And there's so much status in the climate change debate, just all over the place once you start really looking at it. And even not as a debate, just in the general rhetoric and the way that people are talking about it just in general. It's even down to Al Gore getting the Nobel Prize is basically a concession prize for losing the presidency. You know, it's like, this is all, it's all status all the way down. And there's status in, there's great.
You can keep going. I'm just processing that. That's hilarious. I'd never heard it put quite that way. And leave it to a government PhD to just, that's priceless. I love it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Dr. Lyle and I have had that conversation, so that I may have gotten that from him too. So I'm sure it's like we definitely share that sentiment. But so there's one of the most useful roles that anyone could have performed in a Stone Age village was the person who gave early warning of something really, really bad about to happen. And so that's what a lot of this is we're running this Stone Age script we want to be very useful. We want to be useful to the village. And so feeling very worried about climate change and this urgency that we have to somehow change other people's CB around it and their behavior and to, you know, stop the terrible thing before it starts. All of that is very very advantageous to our utility to the village and to our sense of esteem from the village. And the fact is that you can't change anyone's cost benefit analysis. The only thing that is going to change anybody's cost benefit on anything is either a really delicious carrot or a really sharp stick. And, you know, sharing
or in Dr.
a Facebook
Lyle's case,
post
carrot cake, I guess.
Or carrot cake. There you go. That will definitely work for, yeah, yep, there you go. Very delicious carrot. So, but sharing a Facebook post, an alarmist Facebook post about, you know, the crisis that the world is in, or, you know, the latest news about the rise in temperature that we're looking at by 2050, or how it's going to affect the crops or the Amazon or anything like this. This is all, it's all very long-term abstract thinking about people that are not in our immediate village. They don't really exist outside of this myopic human village thinking. And it all also feels like way too big. It's way beyond anybody's ability to affect any of these things directly. So there's no CB in it for people to shift, no matter how alarmist you are, but there's major incentive to be alarmist. So there's no incentive to be a climate change denier. There's no status advantage to sitting back and saying, it's fine, relax, don't worry, no problem. All of the status goes to the prescient sage who warns everybody that the enemy village is coming in and attacking in the middle of the night, or that the volcano is about to erupt, or whatever it is. That's who's really reaping the benefit here. So there's a great, I don't know if people are familiar with the XKCD, which is a great little cartoon. It's a cartoon for nerds, especially math nerds, and it's all stick figures. So it may be where Dr. Lyle draws some of his artistic inspiration from, but there's one where, the stick figure says something like, he's sitting there and he's reading the newspaper and he says something like, you know, it's been a really long time since Earth got hit by a really big meteor. And someone in the background says, oh my God, don't say things like that. And the caption says, I say this kind of thing from time to time because I know that it can't really affect the outcome, but it gives me a tiny chance of looking incredibly prescient. and that's what this is. This is such an advantage.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and it's not falsifiable to be a denier because you can never sit back and say, look, disaster has not happened, the human race is not over with, like, you know, everything is fine. There's always, all it is false positives all over the place. So, and some of those are legitimate causal correlations where there are some changes that, you know, are linked to climate change processes, whether they're man-made or not, and that there is a causal process here, but a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are just weather and volatility and vicissitudes, and the fact that there was a forest fire in California this year does not necessarily mean that it's climate change related. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Not all of them do. Like, it's all false positives. So if you're on the side of alarm, you're being bolstered all the time that you have more evidence that you can point to document how prescient you are. And so this is, you know, it's really well documented that virtually every generation throughout human history has been convinced that it's the last and that Armageddon is coming in its lifetime. Mm-hmm. This is built into the universal value system of the human code, to the end times are coming. And this is just another way that tendency that universal value system is playing out in this context. It doesn't mean that there is not some cause for alarm. There is some cause for alarm. So, I mean, my interest is that there are pretty clearly some real effects. And, you know, my dissertation research showed me this in real time. I mean, I went to these villages. I spent time in them. I saw the erosion with my own eyeballs. There are climate effects that are unusual, that are disproportionately affecting vulnerable, what we might call vulnerable populations. And there's not necessarily anything new about that phenomenon. You know, vulnerable populations have always been disproportionately affected by changes in the environment, and you had more erosion and they would have to move away, and all kinds of things like this. But so we can have that conversation about, you know, broad causality and mitigation. But I'm not a climate scientist. You're not a climate scientist. We might have a few who are listening. Yeah,
I'm
most people aren't.
About the motivation, because, you know, what you just explained, actually, it reminds me, when I was a kid, I asked my dad, I said, do you believe in God? Do you believe in heaven and hell and all that? And he said, well, I don't know. He goes, but he said, but publicly, he goes, why not? You know, if I'm wrong and there is a God, then I can't, you know, then I'm going to hell. But if I'm right, then I'm going to heaven.
Yeah, exactly.
Logically, there's no reason. Yeah.
Yes. He's got the calculus right. Yeah, that is how it works. It's amazingly beneficial to be sounding the alarm, especially when you're surrounded with all these false positives. So I think it's on us as, you know, relatively privileged people, and I use that term with, you know, some tongue in cheek, like, because it's been overused and redefined, but we are privileged in the sense that if we find ourselves living, you and I, if we find ourselves living somewhere that is becoming difficult to live in because the environment has changed in any way, whether it's because it's hotter or there's sea level has risen, or it's just gotten less comfortable for any reason, we have the capacity and the ability to pick up and move to somewhere more comfortable. We have those means, but not everybody does. And the ability to do that does map onto, you know, these identity politics and the groups of people who are systematically less able to take advantage of that mobility than we are. And so for me, it's a moral question. What does that demand of the people who are more mobile, if anything? And what would that mean for what kind of policy we would need going forward? So it's more of an ethical debate than a practical one, the way that I look at it. And this is the kind of ethical debate that you'll see on the fringes of libertarian thinking all the time, because, you know, you can have unfettered free market processes and it's more efficient, which I put in scare quotes, like it's all more efficient, but you do have, you're paying some kind of human cost for that. And we are a social species, and we do have perhaps some responsibility to each other. And so what does that responsibility look like? What is the best way to shape that responsibility and to put it into action? And my dissertation research just showed me that that responsibility is really misconstrued, misunderstood, badly invested in these entire bureaucracies that are trying to build resilience. So that's what they think they're trying to do. But they have it completely turned around. So that's my rant.
No, that's fantastic. So in an effort to find out these vulnerable populations, which are not the majority of populations, you stumbled on to finding out how resilience works in general with other people. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's not an overstatement. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true, because resilience is, you know, like I said last time, it's where personality meets the CB. The CB is being shaped by the environment. So you can't create it. Like, you can't create any kind of blank slate, personality condition. You have to look at the political opportunity structure and the motivational structure that's facing individuals who are looking at a given problem, and what would be the best thing for them to do for their life experience, and why they're making the choices that they're making. And that is just not at all how policymakers are thinking about this problem right now.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, all right. Well, can you, so I understand that you do consult. So you have, Dr. Lyle has said before, and that you have a therapist's personality. Essentially, you're very warm on the phone. I just want to tell our listeners here. I run the Fasting Escape here, and I've had a few patients who have told me that they've had phone consultations with you, Dr. Hawk, and they just said it's like a weight got lifted off their shoulders as you explained to them.
That's really
some
really
of these
nice
processes that were going on, and they feel in a much better position than before. So yeah, tell us a little bit about how you got into phone consults and doing essentially these guiding people with their problems.
Yeah, well, my CB on life in general is that I also want to be as useful as I can be to the village. That's what everybody wants. You want to find the equilibrium where you're getting the right esteem and the right ways from the people that matter, as Dr. Lyle says, and you want to be getting that esteem from giving your best to the village, whatever that is. And so I had always had, among my many crazy jobs that I had over the years, one of them was as a student counselor at a really kind of evil for-profit college. one of these little terrible exploitative places that's selling very high interest loans to these little hapless people who don't know any better, and enrolling them in these very expensive, useless programs. So I think this particular school had like a hospitality program that they were charging like $30,000 for a certificate in hospitality, so you could go get a job as a hotel concierge. Like, really exploitative, shitty stuff. And my job was as a counselor, the student counselor. So I totally inhabited this role. Like, I had the office with the soft light. I turned off the fluorescent and I brought in the lamps, and I had the sweaters and the plants and the macrame.
Crystal balls too, sure.
and totally. Because I've always had, I guess you could call it, a therapeutic personality, where I've wanted to solve problems. I want to help people work through problems and understand what's going on with them. And of course, when I had this job, I did not have the understanding of evolutionary psychology I do now. And I had a mandate from this terrible institution that I actually was supposed to be convincing them to stay in the program at all costs. So they would come in just miserable, hating everything, feeling like they were way in over their heads. And they were. It was basically 100% admissions. If you could pay the bill, and you could pay the bill just by signing on the dotted line of the promissory note. So you were taking out this, like, credit card interest rate loan of whatever it was, like 14%, 19%, 29%, to get this useless degree. And so they would get into it and they would struggle, and their nervous system would be telling them that they were in trouble and that they should probably get out and quit and do something else with their time and energy. And they'd come in, and my job was to convince them to stay. So that was like a soul sucking kind of reverse of what I do now, which is that I really, I find it so fulfilling to talk to people about the problems that they're facing and to find the path out to freedom. You know, like what is it that you're dealing with? Where's the distortion in your thinking that makes you feel trapped? That's so often what people are dealing with. They feel overwhelmed. They feel trapped by things. And really it just is, it can be very helpful to talk to anybody who, but especially somebody who has the skeleton key to the universe that evolutionary psychology really is, to help them sort out why they feel overwhelmed, what their options really are, how they could take systematic action on those options. And that brings with it great relief. I mean, I've experienced that personally. Once I understood the ego trap, when I was in the middle of the dissertation process, and I was deeply ego trapped with the dissertation, deeply. I had written the first chapter and gotten really, really, really positive feedback from my committee, which sounds like a great thing. Like everybody wants positive feedback from their committee, but this was too much. And it threw me, it tipped me right over the edge into the ego trap. So a little bit of praise is good, but more is not better. So everybody has a threshold where it's too much, because I just was like, I can't live up to their expectations. There's no way. I don't have the chops. And so I'm just going to procrastinate this thing and quote unquote self-sabotage, and not deal with it. So, I recognize those dimensions. And when I, understood the ego trap, I realized that that was very much, the situation that I was in. And I experienced that feeling of profound liberation, just by putting one foot in front of the other and attending to the fundamentals of getting out of that trap. So I know how powerful that can be for people, but it's not me. It's the skeleton key.
Well, that's very, very humble answer. And you know, you sound so pleasant, right here on this podcast and in person. So my question is, apparently the solution to get people out of the ego trap, from as we've heard from Dr. Lyle, is sometimes to slightly insult them. So how the hell are you going to slightly insult them when you're such a nice, pleasant person, Dr. Hawk?
I'm congenitally pretty agreeable. I'm a highly agreeable person, but I can muster some disagreeable skittles when I have to. So although I will say that I have never use that particular strategy to get someone out of the ego trap, I just kind of explain the mechanics of it and hope for the best.
And for listeners, I'm probably oversimplifying the strategy. So Dr. Lyle's gonna probably.
Well, no, I mean, it can be very effective. I mean, you will even feel, you'll feel the change in your own nervous system, even if it's not real, if somebody says, I don't think you can do that. Like any problem, even a very hypothetical situation, if I say, and you know that I'm just doing it as we're just talking, this is just a game. And I say, oh, Nate, I don't think you could actually do that. You'll feel like a surge of motivation.
Yeah,
like
watch
it's
me.
Almost like an abstract random, like yeah. I'll show you like, yeah, you think I can't do it's amazing. It's just a mechanical process. And so of course it's exactly the opposite where it's like, oh, you can absolutely do that. That's no problem for you. What are you talking about? You can do that in your sleep. It's like, oh, I don't want to. I don't think that's a good use of time. I think I better go like clean my house again. So yeah, it's very much just a mechanical process. But yeah, Dr. Lyle and I have very different personalities, and I have trouble insulting people, although some of my ex-boyfriends would probably disagree with that.
So. Well, Dr. Hawk, it's been a pleasure having you on. We've had a wonderful, wonderful interview with you. I hope our listeners now get to know you just a little bit more. And for those listeners who are just curious about you, and I know you do phone consults, but there's also, you've got quite a number of videos and some information on your website, which is www.jenhawk.com, spelled JenHawk.com.
Yep. Sounds good.
Well, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure having you. Thank you. Thank you again. And we will look forward to having you on again with Dr. Lyle as well.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Nate. It's been truly a joy as always. So I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.